And you may have to click something to allow yourself to be recorded. This doesn't, they don't record the, or they don't share the visual. They put the audio up on Dharma Seed, which, in case you're interested, Dharma Seed is a great website that has many Dharma talks on it. I'm putting it in the chat. They've got like 100 of my talks on there. Oh, what am I trying to do? I'm trying to send this to everyone in the meeting. Okay. There we go. dharmaseed.org. All right, welcome everyone. And let's start with our sit. So first thing we want to do is establish a comfortable, upright posture. And if sitting upright is a problem, you can certainly meditate lying down, a little easier to stay awake and alert, sitting up. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Certainly no reason to be looking at me while you're meditating. So we turn inward, connect with the sensations of the body first, awareness of the body. How you're holding your posture, the alignment, balance. And as we come into stillness, we begin with encountering the momentum of movement, energy in the body, energy in the mind. And if we sit for a while, a little while, that energy will settle, but sometimes it's difficult to just get started. Just bringing the attention to the breath. Feeling the movement of breath, the sensations of breathing. So just being present with this simple activity of the body, breathing. Having a sense of settling. Be helpful to make a soft mental note with the breath. If you're following the breath at the nostrils, just saying silently in, out, with the movements of breath. Or if you're following the breath at the belly or chest, you could say rising, falling as the belly rises and falls with each breath. The words are just there to help you stay tethered to the sensations, the awareness of breathing. Mind may well continue on with its thoughts and conjectures, memories. But if we can stay in touch with the breath, and we just let the thoughts go. We're not trying to turn off the mind, shut down thinking. Any effort like that just creates more agitation, more disturbance as we struggle with our own thoughts. Rather, we just let them flow through as we stay as connected as we can, as best we can, to the breath and the body. We may also notice sounds or other sensations. We can bring mindfulness to these things as well. In a sense, we are just observing the flow of experience, using the breath as a kind of touchstone, anchor to the present moment. But the breath itself is always changing, always moving. We aren't trying to create some static experience. Rather, to follow along with the movement of mind, movement of sensations, feelings. As we sit, we may become attuned to a subtler experience of mood or feeling, tone, underlying emotions. And just as with thoughts, we notice these, we feel them, Let them go. Come back to the breath. Or we could think of them as things that we breathe with. So the breath is always the companion to the experience. One key moment is the moment of realizing that the mind has wandered, that we're lost in thoughts. There can be a tendency then to jump in and judge ourselves, to think we're doing it wrong or failing, when actually it's quite normal and natural for the mind to wander. What's more helpful in that moment is to drop down into the felt experience. What does it feel like when my mind wanders? Does that feel good? Or can I feel the underlying dissatisfaction, the longing, or the aversion that's driving the thoughts? When we see the unsatisfactory nature of thinking, it weakens our attachment to thought. When we see it really clearly, we see that we're not creating happiness for ourselves by thinking. That it's much more pleasant to rest in awareness, to just be with the breath, be with the body, be with feelings. So that's a great inspiration to be mindful, to let go of our obsessions, our fears, our craving. So here we see the parallel between this meditative process and the process of recovery. It begins with the awareness of suffering, which becomes the motivation for letting go. Right. Welcome again. I am Kevin Griffin. This is Dharma and Recovery. Hope you had a pleasant meditation. I was just thinking about remembering a quote that I wanted to draw from here tonight. And, I need to find the, it's actually a footnote. And yeah, good. I want to talk tonight about something called investigation of states. An investigation of states is a formal term. It's one of the what's called the factors of enlightenment, and it's a integral part of mindfulness meditation. And I think we, in a sense, I think anytime you get really engaged with this practice, you start to do this somewhat organically or naturally. It's sort of a natural thing to do, to sort of look into what's arising, what's showing up in your experience. I mean, it is one of the things about meditation that when you just stop and do nothing for a little while, you're exposed to this kind of the raw nature of being a human being, of your humanness. And it's somewhat striking, you know, even disturbing sometimes, right? You kind of, this is what goes on in my mind. And then tuning in to the other experiences, sensations in the body that, you know, certainly for me, when I started to get serious about meditation, I started to really have a different relationship to my body. It was like I'm tuning into things that I never was aware of before. And then the emotional level or the felt level, tuning in there in ways that, revealed surprising things. And certainly in that realm, in the emotional realm particularly, that was something that as an addict I was trying to get away from. You know, rather than investigating it, I was trying to suppress it or alter it, fix it. But for me, like recovery really, I don't think just for me, I think recovery has to include this new relationship with our mind, with our body, and particularly with our feelings. That's not a effort to control them, and that's a willingness to feel, a willingness to be present, whether things are pleasant or unpleasant, whether they're painful or joyful. Not running from life. I was talking last night. It's been a busy, busy teaching week for Kevin. This is my fifth talk of this week. I never run out of things to say. It's amazing. Just turn me on. We were talking about the one of the teachings around the cause of suffering, and the Buddha outlines these three causes: the sensual desire, sensual craving, and then the craving for existence, or for sort of ego inflation, we could say. And then there's the craving for extermination. It's very interesting that the Buddha saw this and pointed this out, that there's one of the things. It's not something we're experiencing all the time, hopefully, but one of the things that comes up, and I think that's very much related to addiction, is the desire to just shut everything off, to turn it off. Going to sleep, just take a nap. And, so obviously taking certain drugs really turn it off, right? And ultimately, even stimulants are turning off many levels of experience, right? They're not sort of shutting you down the way a opioid would, or being drunk would, but they're putting you into a state that's completely cut off from ordinary emotional experience. So it's just the same. It's still exterminating. It really struck me when I was looking at that word in the text last night that, oh, that's the word in our culture. You use the word exterminating more about killing insects than you do anything else. The idea that we have a craving to exterminate existence is somewhat disturbing. But this is part of this inquiry, this investigation of states. And the one I've been reading and working with this beautiful book called More Than Mindfulness. It's actually available on the Abhayagiri Monastery website. You can download it for free. I'm going to put their web address in the chat, abhayagiri.org. Abhayagiri is a monastery in Northern California. And if you go to their website, then you go to this page that says books, and you look for More Than Mindfulness, you can just download a ebook or a PDF. And I actually have it on my Kindle. It's got the basically transcribed talks from Buddhist monks in the Thai forest tradition, which is the tradition of Ajahn Chah, the great Thai forest master of the 20th century. But this one talk was given by a monk named Ajahn Viradamo. Ajahn is the A-J-A-H-N, A-J-A-H-N. Ajahn just means teacher, and it's an honorific that's given to the monks in that tradition after 10 years of being a monk. So he has a talk that is called Mindfulness, Vitality, and Inquiry. And the inquiry part is about investigation of states. He says, sometimes Buddhism is called a phenomenological practice. That means that in understanding the mind, we try to observe the mind, body, emotions, and moods as phenomena in nature rather than as personal problems. To understand our experience, mind, body, and emotions as phenomena rather than as personal problems. This is a critical idea of Buddhism. And one of the correlations here that I'll make, and it's, well, I'll say it and you'll see what I'm talking about, is that this investigation and this observing of our experience is kind of the Buddhist version of inventory that we do in the fourth step in the 12 steps. And that, I thought that was appropriate to look at that since this is the fourth month of the year, April. So thinking, but the difference here is that in the 12 step inventory, we're viewing our, yes, it says character defects or whatever, so what is it? We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. So we're looking at our moral inventory actually as personal. But in Buddhism, we're trying to look on these things not as personal. And this is, I think, one of the ways that the Buddha Dharma opens up recovery Because on one level, we certainly need to see our behavior and our history and our experience as our own in terms of taking responsibility and having agency. But on the other hand, when we identify solely with those experiences as I, as me, as mine, then that winds up triggering a lot of painful experiences that, in Buddhist terms, dukkha, because it's actually, this is, as I said, that Buddha says one of the causes of suffering is craving for existence, craving for a self, being attached to a self. This is who I am. I did this. I'm good. I'm bad. And that the kind of cycle that we go through with all that ego inflation, ego deflation. And of course, ego and self, these are normal, natural aspects of being a human being, but they are phenomena. They are not solid things. And when we overly identify with them, then we suffer. And we wind up, hating ourselves or adoring ourselves. It's either narcissism or self-hatred. And we really lose the thread. That, I have responsibility and agency around my behavior, and I can make changes with the way I speak and the way I think, even. But I'm really not in control of them at the end of the day, because of the deep conditioning of being a human being. So this goes back to step one. Powerless over self, powerless over thoughts. I mean, when you sit down to meditate, if you think that, oh, this is going to be me controlling my mind, you're very quickly disabused of that notion. And you sit down to meditate and you realize, I can't control my own mind. It's quite humbling, but it's very much like step one. In the 12 steps, you realize, oh, I'm powerless over my mind. That doesn't mean I'm helpless, though. And there's a critical distinction that I always try to make as well around addiction. I may be powerless over alcohol, doesn't mean I have to drink. I may be powerless over my thoughts, but it doesn't mean I have to identify with everything that goes through my mind, or that I have to act on everything that shows up in my mind, or say everything that comes to my mind. The important thing we learn, right? Oh, shut up sometimes. I'm speaking for myself, believe me. So this idea of viewing our experience and using our meditation as an investigation of what's appearing, and we start to see, oh, what are the habits of my mind, right? Where does my mind tend to go? Where does my mind like to go? And you'll see pretty quickly in meditation, and I'm sure many, if not all of you, have experienced this, that you see, oh, well, you discover things about yourself. Wow, I didn't realize I was so this, I mean, I didn't realize that I was so lost in fantasies until I started to meditate. This past fall, I went on a longer retreat, and even after 40 years of meditation, I discovered that I have a lot more anxiety than I realized I had. It's not a great discovery, but there it is. Okay, that's interesting, because I've always identified as a depressive. It's like, wow, is there a relationship between anxiety and depression? Very possibly. But you can hear that I'm also laughing, right? Because this is laughing about what's in our own mind is a sign that we're disidentifying. I'm not claiming that I totally disidentify with my own mind at all, but to some extent, right? And this is part of our training. When you start laughing at your own mind, it's a good sign. It doesn't mean you're going crazy. Usually, I mean, there might be circumstances in which it does, but generally, we can say that it means that you're seeing the absurdity of the mind, because, you know, things show up and you're like, really? I just thought that? Or, oh God, I hope nobody saw that, you know? Yeah. Investigation of states. So I want to bring out something from this traditional text. So this is the a book called the Visuddhimagga. This is a 1,200-page book of a collection of 152 suttas or discourses from the Buddha. And this one is really a well-known one, certainly in Theravada circles. It's the 20th discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's called The Removal of Distracting Thoughts. It's a very, you know, intriguing title, right? A lot of the suttas don't have intriguing titles. You know, they're more generic, or they're more cryptic. This one, or not descriptive. This is very descriptive. So in it, the Buddha gives us five different ways to work with distracting thoughts. And I think this is, number four of those five. And it's one that I'll just say beforehand that, you know, I've read and studied this sutta for many years, and go back to it and investigate it and ask and try to understand it, because it's, you know, it's giving these instructions, right? And that are, you know, very helpful. And I want to understand them. But in each one of them, in these five instructions, there's a simile that can help us understand what the Buddha is saying. And I have to say that for years I had my own interpretation of the simile for this particular step in here. And it wasn't until I noticed that there was a footnote just recently, a month or two ago, that I hadn't read, or I hadn't investigated, I hadn't looked carefully, that I realized that I misunderstood it. So I'm going to share with you this. So I'll read to you this portion of the sutta. And so it has this language that's very much out of the sutta. So he says, if while one is trying to forget their thoughts, this is referring to the previous instruction, and is not giving attention to them, there still arise in them evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion. So this is just him saying, if you're still getting tripped out, you know, if you're still getting really distracted, and this is, you know, because he goes through this process, it's like progressively difficult states, like when you're really stuck, right? So if you're really stuck in your difficult and distracting thoughts, then one should give attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. Now that's the type of statement that tells you nothing, I would say. Give attention to stilling the thought formation. That, I mean, you can sort of get some idea, okay, like I should try to stop making thoughts, I guess it's going, okay. But then he gives us a metaphor. He says, just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. Then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? He would lie down. By so doing, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. So too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, the mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness, concentrated. So it's this image that, you know, you're walking fast. You're, wait, why am I walking so fast? Let me slow down. Oh, well, why am I walking? Oh, let me just stand and just sort of settle. Like, I think I'll just lie down, right? It's just a gradual settling. And I always viewed this as a kind of intentional physical calming, because it's a physical image. So I took it maybe too literally. Like, I'm just going to sit and I'm just going to, like on an exhalation, I'm just going to release tension. And then I'm going to release more tension until I'm just like, oh, and I'm just going to have this idea, which is not a bad strategy. It's not the one that apparently he's really talking about, but it is a strategy. But I'm going to turn now to the footnote so he will reveal what apparently. So there's a commentary, an ancient commentary on these teachings. And it says that this is done by, this is accomplished by inquiring. I'm sorry. Yeah, let me read this. This is accomplished by inquiring when an unwholesome thought has arisen, what is its cause? What is the cause of its cause, etc. Such an inquiry brings about a slackening and eventually the cessation of the flow of unwholesome thought. So this is accomplished by inquiring when an unwholesome thought has arisen, what is its cause? So where the sutta says, the language of the sutta is, one should give attention to stilling the thought formation. So what we're getting out of this is that we're supposed to look at how the thought actually arises. Put it in more contemporary language, where is this thought coming from? Where am I coming from? What's behind this? So I think, again, I think many of you, maybe all of you, have at some point sort of asked yourself a question like that when you're like, what got me thinking about that? And so this could turn into kind of a psychological examination, like, oh, it's because, you know, my mother did this and my sister did that to me, or when I was in school, the people treated me like this. You know, you could look at that kind of causality. But Buddhism doesn't usually try to go back like that quite so much. We're usually more interested in, like, what's going on right now? Like, what's the underlying energetic cause? This is the language I would rather use, rather than psychological cause. Okay, so you're sitting and you find yourself planning your vacation, and you catch that, you breathe, and you go, oh, what's this about? And you just realize, oh, like, I'm really exhausted. Like, I've been working a lot. Or you find yourself, you know, you're going over some painful interaction you had with someone, and you realize, oh, that's not resolved. That's still there. You know, and sometimes, as you can see, some of these things might result in you wanting to take some action. But it can also be that you see, oh, there's a longing in me to escape. You know, or there's a longing in me to be loved. There's a longing in me to control things. Whatever. Often it's a longing, though, I will say. You know, there's a pull, right? And we just sort of, we're just, what is behind it, right? What is the cause? What's going on? And as I say, this can be very much an energetic expression because we're not really trying to fix this or solve this. Because what is the prime aspect of intention that the Buddha points to? It's letting go. So the whole sutta is about the removal of distracting thoughts. It's not about fixing anything or controlling anything. It's just, how can I let go? Because these threads that we get into, they're not bad. It's not bad to be thinking, it's fine. But when we let our minds just churn all the time, it obscures our direct experience. So it becomes like a drug. It becomes like an intoxicant, right? Our thinking becomes another form of escape from reality, another form of extermination. And so this practice is about coming alive, trying to be alive, finding what life is, and not being afraid of life, not running from it, not clinging to it, but being in it, being part of the flow of life. And so when we investigate these energies, we are seeing, much of the time, what we are seeing is all the things that are pulling us away from life. And just letting go of that grasping or that aversion, coming back, is allowing us to be here with things as they are. Now, as I said, I mean, this is antithetical to the project of the addict, right? The project of the addict is to get away. And so if we want to live a life of recovery, it's one in which we're saying, I want to be here for this life. I want to be present for this life. Not always easy, but it's also the most meaningful way we can live, right? So this investigation, I think it's well, let me just say that in meditation, I don't think we always incline towards this kind of inquiry. That because it's difficult just to sit. And if we don't get a certain amount of calm and peace going, then we can't really see things clearly or investigate. So I know that my experience in meditation is often one where I sit and sit and kind of try to settle until I get settled. And then I kind of go, ah, thank you. Now I'll just hang out in this, which is, not an unwholesome thing. Certainly helpful to be peaceful and to be calm. But it's not the end of the process. So what we're being asked to do in this process is to take the time to settle, but then once settled, to start to investigate, to look at what's arising, look at our experience, look at this, at the phenomena of mind, body, feeling. So a couple more thoughts from Ajahn Viradhamo. He says, the body, this is about investigation. The body is a tremendous place to understand the mind. Such an interesting line. The mind and body are very much co-linked. When I feel resentment, my body feels it. I have moods and emotions, thoughts and memories. All of them register in the body. And then he says, my breath channel gets clogged when I feel anxiety. It's a very unusual line, but I really like it. My breath channel gets clogged when I feel anxiety. So again, he's pointing to this process of investigation, which is not, here the investigation is very much not intellectual, and it is very much not trying to even figure something out, but to be present. Because, you know, this key statement, when I feel resentment, my body feels it. So it's not just resentment. When I feel craving, when I feel, you know, anxiety, when I feel sadness, my body feels it. And what we can learn to do with our practice is that when something like that shows up, that instead of going with the thoughts that attach to that feeling, the thoughts that attach to the resentment or the anxiety or the sadness, we go into the feeling of it in the body. Thus, you know, avoiding the mind, taking a detour around the mind into just the felt experience, which is much more reliable. It's not a story. It's not us trying to interpret reality. It is reality. And it allows us then to work with the body in a wholesome way, because when we breathe with these feelings, it allows them to get processed energetically and to get moved through the body rather than getting stuck in the head. Well, I'm taking a cough drop now. Well, this is, I guess, in many ways, kind of the heart of what I teach so much of the time. So it's, I like seeing someone else talking about it. He says, it's a lot simpler to understand resentment as a phenomenon in consciousness than to be lost in the endless scenarios of resentment, to be lost in the endless storylines. Thoughts are very complicated. Yeah, and this, and mindfulness is really in some ways about simplifying. It's about coming back to the basics of experience. You know, our minds overcomplicate things and create these stories. Whereas when you just sit with the breath and the body and feelings, and you just see thoughts as just like words and images going through the mind, it's not so complicated. Quite often we make negative experiences a problem and then we try to fix them. We can get terribly complicated with that. This very simple opening and receptivity to something unpleasant like anxiety is a wonderful freedom. Well, again, this he's talking about how we try to control things. And when we try to control things, you know, you're having an unpleasant experience and you're trying to fix it. It means you're in conflict with reality and you're trying to change reality rather than saying, oh, this is how things are, and just breathing with them and letting them go. And when I say let them go, really what I'm talking about is let them flow, because everything will pass anyway. We don't have to, you know, remove things. They will remove themselves, especially if we don't get into conflict with them. I have spent so much of my practice, he says, trying to control, trying to get rid of things. All that energy never witnesses the way things are. It is just a kind of warfare, a battle zone. That's why we talk about compassion so much, being friendly toward our hindrances, our shortcomings. Again, really very wise. You know, I suspect many of you can relate to this. spent so much of my practice trying to control, trying to get rid of things, get rid of those thoughts, you know. I mean, that's why that sutta, the removal of distracting thoughts, is very intriguing, but you also have to be very careful with it, that it's not about being in conflict with what's in your mind. All that energy never witnesses the way things are because we're trying to change things, trying to fix them, rather than say, well, what is happening? Mindfulness, you know, it's not mind controllingness. It's mindfulness, to be mindful of what is. It's so easy to lose the thread of that idea because we're so habituated to control, to fixing things, that to have a practice that's so simple that just says, oh, no, can you just be with that? Can you just let that be okay? So it brings to mind the classic words of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous: acceptance is the answer to my question, my problems today. Acceptance. Acceptance is a key aspect of mindfulness. If there isn't acceptance, it's almost impossible to be mindful. Because mindfulness is a, it's starts at least with a non-interfering attention. And if you're not accepting things, you're going to be interfering with them. You're going to be trying to control them. So this process is so interesting when we take on this challenge of investigation with acceptance, right? So this is, you know, we're not investigating to fix or to control. We're investigating in order to be fully present with our experience. So I will leave it at that for now and open it up and see if there are any questions or comments. And I'm hopefully, I am the host technically here, and I think that people can unmute themselves. Since I didn't start this meeting, Spirit Rock just turned it over to me, so hopefully you guys can unmute. So if you want to raise your hand in the digital way, or I can't see everybody because I have to scroll between screens, or you could, you know, just unmute and start talking. I'll try to find you. So.
A question.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
I'm curious to know, is there a way I can review everything that you just watched? Because I do see that it's being recorded. There's a lot of really, I'm trying to take notes the whole time because this is the most beautiful experience I've ever had in my entire life. This is my second week doing groups for NA and CMA, and I have had the most difficult few weeks right now trying to feel accepted and be accepted in a place of, you know, such vulnerability. And this is the most beautiful teaching I've had this whole experience. So I just want to know if there's a way I can go back because I couldn't keep up with everything going so fast. And I was taking notes because this is amazing.
Well, that's lovely. Thank you. I am a writer. I've written a bunch of books. So, my first book is called One Breath at a Time, and its subtitle is Buddhism and the 12 Steps. And you know, and you can, my website is just kevingriffin.net too, and so all my books are on there, and there's lots more talks on there as well. I also have a regular Tuesday morning Zoom class, if you're on the West Coast, in the morning, and that's also on my website, so just kevingriffin.net. Yeah, join in.
Thank you so much. This was life-changing, and I needed this. This is just the most gratifying week I've ever had because of this Friday. And knowing that, you know, just 3 years ago, I just celebrated 3 years clean, and
Oh, all right.
to be waiting for that Friday just to get even more and more high. And this is the best high I've ever felt. Sorry, cuts, but this puts heroin in the dirt. Like, I'm so grateful for you. You saved my life. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, it's, these teachings are remarkable. I mean, they're simple and yet so profound, and they certainly changed my life. So I'm happy to be able to pass on my own understanding. It's definitely a joy, a gift. So thank you. Anybody else want to praise me? No, I'm kidding. Thank you. Seriously, any questions or comments?
Kevin, good
Yes,
evening.
Richard. Hello.
Hello, Kevin. My name is Richard here in Santa Rosa. Pleasure to be with you tonight. I keep reflecting tonight how I'm thinking about the sixth and seventh step a lot. And I've read your writings about kind of interpreting all of the steps, but six and seven in particular. I keep thinking in relationship to, these are like, it's a beautiful step to, how to remove qualities of ourself that create suffering. And I keep thinking, with the idea that on one hand, like how to work with letting go of defects of character. I don't even like the term defects of character, but like causes of suffering. And I'm drawn to the Tibetan creativity of bringing images and ideas for how to kind of replace it. Like to me, it feels like to identify them and to try to let them go doesn't feel like enough. Like I'm always wanting to also then in the meditation to be generating thought or creativity around the replacement of or the something that goes in the place of something, and I'm wondering if you can kind of speak to how, if that's what the Buddhist practice might say to that idea of replacing,
Well, replacing is actually the first in that sutta, the removal of distracting thoughts. The very first instruction is often referred to as replacing. So it's not at all alien to the early Buddhist teachings, the idea of replacing. I would start, to me, I want to start by kind of making friends with those difficult parts of myself. Not starting with, I need to change this, or I need to have this removed. Because again, I think that can set us up as kind of judging ourselves or judging some part of ourselves or thinking that something is broken, or, and because I don't know that, I don't know that we're never going to become different people until like our next lifetime, I think. For this lifetime, we're kind of, in some sense, we're who we are. That is the sort of outlines of our personality are kind of, in place. So first, I feel like I need to make friends with, or not sort of have this necessarily judgmental, conflicted relationship with these aspects of myself, and then see if, rather than starting by replacing them, I might transform them into more wholesome uses. So, for instance, this is my own experience that I mentioned this before, that I realized that, oh, I had a mind that really liked to make stuff up, and I could live in fantasies a lot, like smoke a joint and sit around and talk about all the things I was going to do. And that was unwholesome. It wasn't helpful. But that capacity to imagine is actually what allows me to write books and write music, which are things that I do. So it's creative. It's not about removing that quality. It's about transforming it into its positive manifestation. Because any quality, just, I mean, most, you know, even the quality of like greediness can have a wholesome manifestation. It's where you're wanting to, experience things. You know, like I really want to get enlightened. You know, I'm greedy for enlightenment, right? I'm it's like the and so we and you know that it's interesting. One of the things in the Tibetan prayer flags. I remember a friend of mine who was very much in that tradition said one of those flags is the flag for like anger, but anger that's critical thinking. That's so like not just accepting things that are not acceptable, right? So this is how I prefer to think about this process rather than trying to get rid of, these emotional patterns and personality patterns tend to be sort of in place. And then it's how can I manifest them in positive and wholesome ways?
So my defects are like caterpillars that can become butterflies.
There you go.
Thank you.
You've even got a poem now you can work on with that, you know.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, no, it's thank you for bringing that up. Other thoughts or comments this evening? Or if you're in Australia this morning.
just a quick question.
Yes.
The material, in the latter part of your talk that you were reading from and discussing, was that in that book on the website that you mentioned was downloaded?
Yes. Yeah, it's called, I'm writing it down, More Than Mindfulness, it's called. And yeah, it's on Abhayagiri.
Thank you. Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of my favorite book right now. I've been teaching out of it quite a bit. I like things that are real, I guess is the simplest way, you know, that really say something direct, that aren't setting sort of lofty ideas, like I'm supposed to experience emptiness or transcend everything, but when people really talk about the lived experience of being in a body and a mind and how to work with that, I'm drawn to that. Yeah. There is a bug flying around in my office. Huh. I'm a bug. Any other thoughts?
Hey, Kevin.
Mike. Hey, hi.
Hey, yeah, that More Than Mindfulness is a great little book, isn't it?
You got a copy?
But yeah, just downloaded it off.
Yeah.
The website. But yep. What I was going to, since we have a little time, I was going to ask you about the feelings in the body and how the link between the mind and the body and where, maybe not where, but how you feel them. It seems like I'm always kind of not quite sure of these, where I feel these things. I mean, to me, they always kind of register in the gut. And I hear so many different, you know, ways that people talk about this. And the way he's talking about it in this article, it almost sounds like fear of heights is the little toe and anxiety of eating beats as the second toe, and
Yeah.
I just don't get that kind of definition.
Right.
It's to me, it's kind of like a big mishmash in my gut. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I'm with you there. Because what we're talking about when we're talking about this felt experience, the Vedana, is insubstantial. It's not like a headache, or a stomach ache, or it's much. That's why I use the word energy, because it feels like more like a flow of things, and it has like a mood attached to it very often, and that's where it isn't for me so important to zero in and like really like pay attention. Oh, what's that exact sensation of that feeling? It's more to me about being opening and breathing so that my mind isn't closing around this negative feeling, that it's kind of giving space to it, so that I'm not really. I'm trying to, if I think of it as energy, I'm trying to let it move through rather than like move in. And so it's kind of breathing and feeling and seeing in that moment, in that breathing and feeling, not just, oh, there's a feeling there, but that feeling comes along with this narrative, this story. And the story might just be, oh, this again. It can be it. Or it can be more elaborate than that, but it's a story that's kind of like connected to like who I think I am, because these feelings are very familiar, this is a bad one, or this is a good one. Oh, I'm gonna ride this one. Oh, I'm good. I'm in a good mood today. I'm gonna be really productive. I felt like that this morning. I was like, oh, I'm gonna work on this book, and I sat down. I started working on the book, and it just like fell apart. And I was like, oh, this sucks. And like, okay, you know what? There's golf on. I'm gonna make a cup of tea and watch some. It was just like, this is unpleasant, but I'm if I sit here and start to build a story about what's wrong with this book that I'm writing, or I thought I was writing, why I'm gonna have to throw it out, whatever, how important it is, I'm just gonna get in a bad mood. It's like, you know what? It's just a thing. It's just an idea, something. So yeah, to me, it's not about grabbing onto and identifying the feeling and just, okay, being mindful, like mindful of the breath, like, oh, every sensation coming in now, oh, every nuance of this feeling. It's more just, oh, there's a feeling there. Oh yeah, I recognize that one. Okay. And just give it space and keep going. What's a wise way to move on with my day, given that there's this feeling here? Do I need to call a friend? Do I need to work out? Do I need to take a nap? What do I need to do? I don't know. I hope that. Go
No, I
ahead.
like that. I like the idea of thinking of it as energy because it keeps you from associating too much with it and really making the feeling and the story with it more concrete. Just try to depersonalize it. And so I have this anxiety, I'm trying to just relax, breathe, accept the feelings, and then hopefully be able to let them go.
Yeah, it's like Viridama says, see it as phenomena, just observing it as phenomena. So there is that aspect of mindfulness that's like trying to be sort of scientific, just like, oh, this is the experience of this. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that viewing your kind of mental formations as phenomena.
Yeah.
The scientist in me really likes that part.
Very good. All
Thanks,
right,
Kevin.
I think we'll wrap it up. Let's do a little closing dedication of merit. So just sitting back for a moment, you can close your eyes again, take a breath. And remembering that our practice is not for us alone, just as our recovery is not for us alone. 12th step says that having had a spiritual awakening, we tried to carry this message. And we can carry the message just by being loving, compassionate, and wise. May our practice and our recovery be of benefit to all beings. May all beings be free from suffering. Thank you all for showing up and hanging out tonight. Hope to see you in person or online. To find out where I'm going to be, just go to my website. And I am going to be out and about. I'm teaching a class in San Francisco on the next 2 Thursdays. It's been a four weeks. I've done the first two. And a couple of retreats coming up as well. So hope to see you all there.
Thank
if you,
you
want to unmute and say good night, you are. So
good night, Kevin.
Well,
good night, Kevin. Thank you so much.
Hi.
Right. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Thank you.
Oh, you have a friend. That's nice.
Thank
right.
you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.